Nowhere in the pages of history can one find a greater champion of justice. Return with us now to those thrilling days of yesteryear.
And I'll tell you something else, too, is I cannot stand sissies.
You're going to talk about wrestling, that's redneck talk.
Talk to Jumpin' Jeff Farmer. Let's go now to that interview. Folks, there's Jumpin' Jeff Farmer. Jeff, a while back, what a match you had with Motley.
Yep.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Carl Stern Classic Wrestling Audio Show here at WrestlingObserver.com, Figure4Online.com. I'm Carl Stern of CarlStern.com. Thanks a lot for listening. This is show number one of a Carl Stern marathon this week. We've been doing the History of Wrestling series for a while now, and foregoing our usual way of doing shows, which is you write in with questions and topics, and we discuss them on future editions of the show. So it's been a while since we've done this, and we've let the questions build up, and now we're going to take a look at those in kind of a marathon session this week. I want to encourage you, if you haven't done so already, if you follow Twitter, you can follow me at Dragon King Carl. I have my own website, CarlStern.com. And also on Facebook, I am Carl Stern. And that's Carl with the letter K, K-A-R-L-S-T-E-R-N. Carl Stern, CarlStern.com. Okay, let's hit a bunch of emails. Got a bunch of email topics, questions, just some listener mail and whatever. And so we're going to work our way through those. First off, this comes from David. David says, just want to send you a note of thanks for the excellent Carl Stern Classic Wrestling audio show. Specifically speaking about the one I posted several weeks ago where I took a trip down to the Gulf Coast. Says, I really enjoyed hearing how you grew up with wrestling and especially enjoyed the added bonus of the recording occurring during the tropical storm while you were on the Gulf Coast. That was a nice added layer to the recording. I've actually listened to that half of the show twice already. Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate that. That was a fun, memorable little trip. I'll have to do that again. I've been having some problems with my bike. This is, like, I've always owned Honda Shadows. Like, that's always been, like, my bike. It's just, I just know how they work. It's just, it's not particularly my, I'm just enamored with them. It's just that I've always had them, and I just am used to them. But this latest one I have, man, it's probably the most beautiful bike I've ever owned, and it's also probably the most troubled bike I've ever owned. I'm just constantly having some kind of little nagging problem with it, and so I don't know how much longer I'm going to hold on to this bike. I had just another problem with it this week where it was just annoying little crap on this thing, and so I may be trading for a different model, so that particular bike may be going by the wayside. I don't know. It's going to have to straighten this act up for sure if it wants to hang around any longer. All right, next question up is from Matt. He says, Carl, who was the wrestler or wrestlers who used the nickname Nightmare? There have been several, actually, that I'm familiar with. First of all, there was a tag team, the Nightmares, and I'll get to them in a second, but there's actually have been some non-Nightmare tag team related wrestlers. One of them was Randy Colley, who is better known, I guess, as Moondog Rex. He was also the first Demolition Smash before he was replaced by Crusher Khrushchev, who was become the more well-known member of Demolition. Barry Darsaw is his actual name. And, of course, Barry Darsaw and the Masked Superstar, Bill Eadie, become the most famous version of Demolition, longest lasting. But for one TV taping, at least, and there is footage out there, it was on YouTube, I don't know if it still is, of Randy Colley as the first Smash. And, of course, like I said, he was Moondog Rex. He's been a few other gimmick characters along the way, mostly. A Detroit Demolition was somebody he played after he was stripped of the Demolition gimmick and went back on the territorial circuit. He did Detroit Demolition and down in Memphis and also in Alabama. But he was the Nightmare in Mid-South. Wrestled with a mask on, and it was different than the other Nightmares. I mean, because he was a big, stocky guy, big, you know, powerhouse kind of wrestler. The other Nightmares relate around the tag team that started in Memphis. And initially, the most famous version is Ken Wayne and Danny Davis. Okay, Ken Wayne is the son of a longtime Memphis wrestler named Buddy Wayne, and that's not the same Buddy Wayne from the Pacific Northwest who is well known to fans of the Figure Four Wrestling website. It's a different guy. This Buddy Wayne, Memphis wrestler, his son Ken Wayne wrestled under a number of gimmicks, also his real name, and then he ended up hooking up with Danny Davis. And Danny Davis, this is not the same Danny Davis who was the referee up in WWF back in the 80s. This was a guy who traveled around quite a bit. He was up in Calgary for a while. He worked, of course, Memphis a lot. And they put on masks and became a mass tag team. And they were not just the Nightmares. They were also the Galaxians for a while. And they really got popular as the Nightmares. Multi-time Southeastern Tag Team Champions down for Ron Fuller's Southeastern Wrestling Promotion, and also up in Memphis for the for Jerry Jarrett's group. But there was also alternate members. There was Ted Allen, who the first version of the Nightmares was Ted Allen and another guy who I can't for the life of me remember his name. It's probably somebody you've not even heard of, and his name escapes me. In fact, I'd never heard of him, and I can't remember what his name was. But anyway, they ended up, for whatever reason, Ted Allen ended up leaving, and ultimately, within a very short period of time, like a couple weeks, it ended up settling in on Ken Wayne and Danny Davis, and they became the Nightmares and were continued to be the Nightmares up to the early 1990s. Danny Davis is the guy who went on to own Ohio Valley Wrestling. And Ken Wayne runs a wrestling school in Tennessee. He I think, promotes sometimes. He's been around the independent scene ever since, you know, the territories went under. I saw Ken Wayne last, I guess, it's been several years ago. He was doing some independent work. I haven't seen Danny Davis in many, many years, but because he, you know, moved back up to Louisville, Kentucky, and opened Ohio Valley Wrestling up there. But Ted Allen went on. He spun off and kept the Nightmare mask and the gimmick as well, and wrestled as the Nightmare Ted Allen for also all the way up till he passed away a couple years ago. He was a regular in Georgia wrestling on the independent scene, working a lot for Jerry Oates and his company, and I mean everywhere, all kinds of shows used Ted Allen. Ted Allen was a very good in-ring wrestler, far, far better than he's remembered as being, because he never was super popular. He was always a lower card guy. He wasn't particularly charismatic, but he was a good solid hand in the ring. He also worked out from under the Nightmare mask. I mean, he was just Ted Allen as well. I remember him getting a few runs in Alabama for Southeastern Wrestling, usually as a lower card wrestler, opening card wrestler. And again, you know, he worked all the Outlaws and all the independent shows later on as the Nightmare. Let's see, the other guy whose name totally escapes me, and I gotta look this guy up because I can't remember who he was. David something, maybe. Hang on, if only I had a device that I could type this into and look up the question, look up the answer. And it was Billy Starr. Billy Starr and Ted Allen were the. That doesn't, for some reason, that doesn't sound right. Okay, maybe Billy Starr didn't come along till the Deep South days. Maybe it was Ted Allen and Ken Wayne, Ken Wayne and Ted Allen who were the original Nightmares. And then, I think that's what it was, okay. And then Ted Allen left out and was replaced with Danny Davis. Okay, and then Ted Allen and Billy Starr revisited the Nightmare gimmick down in Deep South Wrestling in the very late 1980s and feuded with Ken Wayne and Danny Davis in a Battle of the Nightmares. And Jody Hamilton was the promoter down in Deep South Wrestling. It was over in Georgia, and they taped at a nightclub over there and had some television exposure. They were even syndicated a little bit in the Southeast. And it was actually a pretty good little promotion. It just, it was just small scale, kind of at the end of the territorial era. They were the ones who had, Mr. Wrestling 2 and Tommy Rich worked there. I think Austin Idol made a few shots, Randy Rose and such as that. But again, the trademark feud from that organization was Nightmare versus Nightmare. And Ted Allen and Billy Starr reprised that role. So you have, of the Nightmares, you have Ken Wayne, you have Danny Davis, you have Billy Starr and Ted Allen, and you have Randy Cully are the five that I can think of off the top of my head as having done the gimmicks. So, and if there was another Nightmare, I'm not talking about, I'm sure there's probably a million indie geek Nightmares, but anybody that actually went anywhere and done anything, if anybody could think of any others, for sure send them in, because I'd like to know. I'm sure the gimmick's probably been done somewhere else, but that's the ones I know of. Okay, let's see here. This is from Ryan, and Ryan says, "Your show being archived at F4W Online is the main reason I'm now a paying member. Thank you for the shows you've done and continue to do." Well, thanks a lot. I appreciate that. He says, "Ric Flair was known for carrying fair to decent workers to good or great matches. Can you think of any examples of guys who had bad matches, who he had bad matches with due to their poor in-ring skills?" There were a few examples. There were some lugs even he couldn't carry. And then sometimes, just bad chemistry together. Thinking back to just people I watched in my area, which was Continental, Southeastern Wrestling, I remember one of the top babyface stars during the Continental era was a guy named Wendell Cooley. Wendell Cooley was also known in some areas as Rick Casey. He was a popular, good-looking, kind of undercard babyface. He got kind of popular down in Mid-South area where he teamed with Al Perez in sort of an underdog tag team. He had a short run down in Puerto Rico as well with Frankie Lancaster, the Heartbreakers or Heartthrobs or something like that. Worked in Memphis, but he mainly worked the Ron Fuller's Southeastern promotion as a job guy, kind of an undercard, a low-card guy for a long time. But he just kept, he developed into a pretty good worker. He, around 1986, late 85, early 86, he was really good. But he just kind of stagnated. He never really improved, I think, to the degree that a lot of people hoped he would. He had kind of a natural charisma, but he wasn't just off the charts by any means. And he was very regionally popular. He's not a guy I think could have went to New York or even maybe Mid-Atlantic and become a big star. He had more of that kind of good old boy down home sort of fan base to him, especially with the women. The women were his primary fan base because he was a good looking guy with really good hair and stuff, so he was kind of that. But he was wasn't a bad worker at all. Like I said, around 85, 86, he was actually a really good worker. But again, he just kind of he just kind of stalled out in his development and so forth. He had at least one match I remember with Ric Flair where I think he won the Alabama title tournament. The Alabama title was like the low rung belt for Southeastern and Continental Wrestling. Wasn't always around. Sometimes it would just kind of fade away and they'd bring it back and whatever. It was just kind of like the modern version of what would be like the Intercontinental title, where it was just kind of out there, or the U.S. title, even better example. It was just kind of out there. They would put it on guys who they were looking to give a push or who needed a belt in their program, but it wasn't a main event belt. But I think the circumstances surrounding it was Jerry Stubbs was the champion, who was also known as Mr. Olympia, but he was Jerry Stubbs, a heel at the time, and he threw the belt off of the bridge in Mobile. And, you know, every area, every territory had this throw the belt off the bridge angle as a big heel move to disparage the belt. And what happened was he was stripped of the championship and was put up in a tournament. And the tournament was won by Wendell Cooley. And I think, if I remember this correctly, that the winner of the tournament also got a shot at the world champion Ric Flair. Now, this was right at the end of Continental recognizing the NWA world title, because at this point in time, Ric Flair was largely just working the Mid-Atlantic states. He was kind of, the NWA had quit touring the belt so much, and a lot of territories were switching over to recognizing the AWA title, the few territories that were left that weren't killed off yet. And that's what happened with Continental. Just, this may have been one of the last times Ric Flair came through before they switched over to recognizing the AWA title. But regardless of that, Ric Flair came and on television wrestled Wendell Cooley. And I just remember it being a bad match. It was just, you could just tell Ric Flair was so many levels above Wendell Cooley. It wasn't a terrible cluster of a match, but it wasn't a good one at all, especially considering the level that Ric Flair usually had and the kind of heat he had with people like Bob Armstrong, who was well up in his 40s at that point in time. The matches with him were a lot better and a lot more heated, and just seemed like nobody really cared or thought Wendell Cooley had a chance in the world, which of course he didn't, and they tried. But that one match stands out in particular. I know Jerry Lawler had a match with Ric Flair at the Mid-South Coliseum that was never televised. There was the one famous time that Ric Flair showed up at the television studio, and they had a real good angle there. But then I think it was 85. Might have been later, but I think it was 85, that during one of the Great American Bash tours, they stopped at Mid-South Coliseum, and Ric Flair wrestled Jerry Lawler for the world title. Now, generally speaking, the world title in Memphis was the AWA world title, but for some reason they worked out a short deal where he came in. And I know Jerry Lawler didn't like the match. He thought it... He never showed it. I mean, he never showed it on television. It was never brought up. And in fact, Ric Flair came back a few months later and wrestled Coco Beware. Jerry Lawler didn't even wrestle him because Lawler just didn't like the way that he and Flair gelled. So that would be two really great workers who just didn't click there. And, of course, later on, I mean, in his later years, Ric Flair, was hit and miss, especially, you think his last match with Sting was just bad, but he's a beat-up, mid-60-year-old, guy just who has no business being in the ring. But as far as back in his prime, back in the pinnacle of his career and stuff, trying to think to his first WWF run. I know he and Bret Hart didn't gel the best in the world, but I certainly don't think any of their matches were bad. I know, of course, Bret Hart didn't speak highly of him at all and thought their matches weren't that good, but I know most everybody at the time thought they were pretty good matches, but I don't remember particularly being blown away by them or anything. trying to think territory. You know, Ric Flair wrestled some real lugs. I mean, especially during his early title runs, his first few. I mean, he wasn't Larry Hamilton. It was who was the other guy, the football player? Gosh, I can't think of that guy's name. Charlie Cook, I think. He wrestled Charlie Cook down in Florida for the world title of all things, and I think that match was pretty universally despised. Also, let's see, trying to think who he would have. There's got to be somebody in Texas that he just absolutely stunk out with, but I mean, he carried the Von Erichs to some good matches, and like Kerry especially when he was even in no shape to work, but can't really think of any clunkers he might have had out there or in Missouri, for that matter, Central States or something. So, yeah, I mean, you know, he's had a few along, but generally speaking, I mean, he really could carry people for some good matches. Okay, the next one I've got is something, quite honestly, I don't know the answer to. I've heard about it before, and I probably honestly read it the same place he did, but I don't know much more about it. So if anyone has any more details about it, especially if it's a good story, I'd love to hear it if you want to send it in. This comes from Kenny. He says, I've started reading the book Sex, Lies, and Headlocks, The Real Story of Vince McMahon and the World Wrestling Federation. I had read it when it first came out in 2002 and just recently picked it up with my Kindle app. It goes on to say, one of the greatest app of all time. I love the Kindle app. I have it on my iPad. I was one of the first people to get a Kindle. I bought one of the first generation ones that cost like $400, and it was, you know, slow as Christmas and all this, but I loved the Kindle, loved it. And I had that same Kindle. That thing was reliable as hell up to just, like I gave it to my friend Nathan, not 6 months ago. The thing still works. He still reads off of it. But once I got my iPad, I got the Kindle app, and I still read all my old stuff on there. So yeah, you know, if you got an iPad, iPhone, whatever, you definitely need the Kindle app, or to get, like, Kindles are so inexpensive now too. They're absolutely great. And I've got some material on there. I've got some old Dragon King newsletters on there and collected editions. I've got a novel I wrote called Absence of Absalom. So you can check all those out for your Kindle app. But anyway, he goes on to say, my question here revolves around a story early in the book about Jess McMahon being suspended by the New York Athletic Commission. The book only states that there was a scandal that a couple of managers tried to con a fighter out of about $5,000 and involved some bogus contracts on file with the commission. The book states that Jess, quote, winked at the deal but didn't play an active role in it and ended up taking the fall in the end. Do you have any knowledge or more detail about this? I really don't. Jess McMahon was primarily a boxing promoter. Boxing, of course, back then was gigantic. Wrestling was in the dark ages at that point in time. But it was also a very dirty business, very dirty. I mean, boxing is just infamously a dirty business. Wrestling gets a negative connotation, deservedly so for a lot of things. But, you know, boxing, I've never understood why it's still so highly revered with all the craft that goes on there. I mean, boxing is not as worked as pro wrestling by a long shot, but there's been a lot of it going on over the years, and just some of the most corrupt people in the world. Of course, wrestling, not, I mean, just the way that you know, Vince McMahon bullies around people like JR and stuff, and just all the, I mean, you know, you guys know, if you listen to this show, you know all the scandals that have happened and everything else, so we're certainly no bastion of glorious behavior over here by any stretch of the imagination, but boxing doesn't get browbeat the way it probably should, truth be known. All right. So I don't know, but somebody can send in something. All right, when we come back, the next half of the show, we'll go ahead and take a break here because the next one's kind of lengthy. It concerns the discussion about Owen Hart for the Hall of Fame. Now, by the time you hear this show, the Wrestling Observer Hall of Fame issue will have already came out, and so it's really a non-factor at this point to discuss it, but I brought it up and we talked about different people, and it's relevant for next year if he didn't get in, but we're going to discuss some of the Hall of Fame talk. So we'll take a break, come right back, and do that here at the Carl Stern Classic Wrestling Audio Show.
Right now. Certainly one of the true international wrestling stars in the world today is with us right now, Mr. Ric Flair.
The international wrestling star of all time. The golden-haired stallion, Mr. Everything, Ric Flair, the nature boy, the man that drives them wild everywhere he goes. Custom-made from head to toe, whether it be one of my custom-made robes, custom-made suit, my custom-made Rolls Royce, my jet, or one of my lovely ladies. Wherever I am, people know they are seeing the best, because Ric Flair is the toughest piece of work in pro wrestling today. Wahoo McDaniels, Steamboat, Wrestling 2, Wrestling 1, Tony Atlas, all these fellas just trying to be where Ric Flair already is, at 27, a millionaire, anything he wants, any woman he wants, just like that. You know why? Because my name is Ric Flair, the greatest, the legend, the Young Crown World Champion. Ladies and gentlemen, if you have a chance to see Ric Flair, don't miss it.
Well, I can see Mr. Idol is
there. You know, first of all, I don't know what this guy Sullivan is talking about, but darling, I'm here. All you have to do is sign the contract, and I'll be ready. You better remember one thing. I'm the greatest all-around athlete of all time. When I first came here, you know it's only been a few short weeks, and Idolmania has exploded like a nuclear rocket off the launch pad in Cape Kennedy, and I have created an avalanche. Not only a fan mail, I've created an avalanche of furious, frustrated women seeking to get one sexy kiss from Austin Idol. And not only that,
Tuesday night, sir. Tuesday night, if I may.
Men. And on the top of that list is this cat by the name of Flair talking about how great he is, and he can do this, and he can do that. Well, in the Omni, Christmas night, darling, I'm going to be right there. I'm going to have my Las Vegas leg lock, and I'll be ready to meet you head on, Flair, and we'll find out. You know, we talk about originality. Flair, you're the one who calls yourself Nature Boy, and everybody knows Buddy Rogers was the original Nature Boy. The Las Vegas leg lock is coming for you, Flair. You better be ready Christmas night. We'll find.
All right, and we're back. And again, let me remind you, if you're on Twitter, I'm Dragon King Carl. Go to my website, carlstern.com. You'll see all my social media outlets there. Facebook, I am Carl Stern, so add me up there. If you don't have a Stern stick yet, the Stern Stick 2 is available. It's a flash drive with 4 gigabytes of audio and other wrestling-related material on there. There's even some After Dark type stuff on there, a lot of exclusive audio that's not archived anywhere else. So do check that out. That's all available at carlstern.com. I would greatly appreciate you checking out the Stern Stick 1 and 2. Okay, the Hall of Fame discussion, this is sent in by Josh. He says, really enjoy the show, appreciate you doing them. Just a couple thoughts on the Hall of Fame ballot, Owen Hart in particular. I think time and circumstances have clouded people's views on him. He was obviously a tremendous worker, but he was never a top guy in any real sense of the word, even when he was feuding with Bret in 1994. That was his spot because of who he was related to, not because who he was. If I remember correctly, they originally even wanted Bruce Hart, which would have been a disaster. And that's actually true. They did want Bruce Hart in that role. And I think Bret and Pat Patterson ended up pulling for Owen Hart to get it. And it, you know, turned out to be at WrestleMania 10, one of the best matches on the show. And between it and the ladder match, really put in a lackluster pay-per-view over the top there. Says Owen never really caught on with people when he wasn't involved in a program directly or indirectly with Bret, which, to be fair, only really happened post-1997. When Bret left after Survivor Series and Owen was positioned higher on the card, starting with his attack on Shawn Michaels at the DX pay-per-view in December, he didn't catch on and he floundered for the rest of his career, and his ill-fated and illogical pairing with The Nation of domination, his mid-card tag team with Jeff Jarrett, his unfortunate reprise of his Blue Blazer role. Plus, his work had deteriorated badly because of injury, age, and I assume probably not quite caring as much once Brett left. His feud with Ken Shamrock was fun, but it was goofy fun, like the dungeon match at the Fully Loaded show. That wasn't a great match by any means, but it was a fun and a goofy sort of mid-card way. As a worker, he was obviously very, very good, but I don't think he was as good as a guy like Kurt Hennig. I scratch my head when people say he was the best worker from the Hart family, because for me, he can't touch Brett. I never thought his psychology was as good as Brett's, nor does his offense look anywhere near as believable. Owen's punches always looked goofy, and his offense was never the style that made me think, hey, this guy can beat anybody. I realize that may be an antiquated way of looking at professional wrestling, but with Brett or a guy like Hennig, his style, psychology, and offense was such that I thought he had a chance to beat anyone, whether it be a monster like Diesel or a technician like Flair. Brett's style looked like he could be the best in the world on any given day, and Owen just never did. Brett could play heel or babyface, and there's a typo there, and I can't really make out what it's supposed to be, but it says, anyway, Owen to me really couldn't. He was typecast as a chicken shit heel who was athletic or in Stampede as an underdog babyface. Owen was never a draw, was never on top of a major promotion, and his work, while great, isn't any better than someone like Hennig. Hennig was at least given, albeit dying, National Promotions main title and had a run with it. He was pushed hard, if not harder, than Owen during their respective peaks in WWF. If the argument is Owen was a strong, often outstanding performer who should be in based on the merit that his death was a tragedy, national news, and therefore made him a bigger name because of it, well, that's fine, because it is what it is. I just think someone like Hennig or Steve Williams are really more suited to get in. Or someone like Kira Tawe, who isn't even on the ballot despite being involved in 13 or more Meltzer-rated 5-star matches. So anyway, sorry for the long-winded email. Appreciate the show and always look forward to listening. Well, thanks, Josh. I appreciate that. I don't know if I've talked about the Hart family. It's been a long time ago, so I'll just kind of say my piece on them. I never have been as high on the Harts and the whole Stampede thing as a lot of other people have. And I've said in the past, I took a lot of heat for, you know, saying Dynamite Kid's overrated and all this good stuff and whatever, to each of their own. You know, it's not something I'm passionate about that, you know, just... But to me, I always found... A good friend of mine from years ago, who actually we worked together on a number of projects, including promoting a wrestling promotion together, a guy named Rick Gillespie, who has done a lot of pioneer podcasting, websiting, and stuff like that, wrestling hotlines. He's from up in the Baltimore area. A lot of you probably know who he is. He was always a big Bret Hart fan, and he and I had this discussion on several occasions. I never was that big on the Harts. I always found them, quite frankly, rather bland. Brett grew on me in time. I always was much higher on Shawn Michaels than I was Bret Hart because I just found Shawn Michaels a more intriguing personality. Undoubtedly, they're both world-class in-ring performers, although Bret Hart did seem to be quite repetitive, and to me, he's quite hypocritical in, like, downing Ric Flair for his repetitive matches, and Ric Flair was repetitive, no question about it, but Ric Flair, for a lot of his career, in earning his stripes, and in different areas, it didn't matter as much, because I think he was more formulaic. He became repetitive later on. He did, you know, develop the quote Ric Flair match, but Bret Hart was repetitive too in his matches. With, of course, the five doom moves of doom or whatever it was called. But, you know, I got to a point where I could essentially call a Bret Hart match almost move by move, certainly spot to spot. And he just, I found Bret very entertaining as a heel. More so than a babyface. To me, he was just bland. I just could not get behind him as a baby face. I was used to, and again, it's a regional thing. I was used to my baby faces being guys like who I or my, you know, or the people around me could relate to, who showed a lot of fire. People like Bob Armstrong, Jerry Lawler, who gave you a reason why they were the local good guy, the hometown hero, or whatever, fighting the forces of bad, or, you know, some dastardly heel. You know, there's always, Ron Fuller was always bringing up some sort of stable to run Bob Armstrong or somebody like that off. Jerry Lawler was always fighting, you know, Jimmy Hart or Jim Cornette or whoever the case may be, bringing in different people to run him off. And they always, through their promos, gave you a reason for cheering for him. Hulk Hogan, of course, you know, always the big muscled blonde guy who preached, you know, good values and Americana and apple pie and all that good crap against a bigger monster than him. Okay, that, you know, while not necessarily deep, was something you could get in. Bret Hart, I never knew his motivation. He never sold me on why I should like him. I mean, he was a good in-ring wrestler, yes, but he never sold me on what his motivation was, why I should be cheering for him. Owen, I think he was colored more by, when he was coming up in Stampede, he was just a blow-away wrestler. He was just very dynamic. He was going up against these big heels like Mackenzie and people like that who could catch him flying around. He goes down to Mexico, goes over to Japan. He starts doing basically what Chris Benoit and Ultimo Dragon and people like that were doing, Jushin Liger. They were getting schooled in all these different styles. Eddie Guerrero, another example, where he was adding a lot, and he looked like he was really coming up to be a major star, a very, very gifted wrestler. But I agree, at some point in time, he just sort of stopped developing. He stopped being motivated. And, you know, just reading books about his life and stuff, and the one his wife wrote about him, I mean, it really seemed like he wasn't passionate about wrestling, and that it was something he happened to be very good at. It was something he happened to be very natural at. It's something his family was involved in, but he didn't seem to have a lot of passion, and so he only developed to a certain level, but that level was a very, very good. So, kind of looking back in retrospect, he is a guy who, in all likelihood, could have ended up being a Hall of Famer, but probably never developed to that degree. So I have kind of backed off on my thoughts about... I didn't vote for him in the Hall of Fame, by the way. I finally just kind of wrote it off as, you know, not a strong enough case for him. And certainly his death was a tragedy. It did bring enormous publicity to wrestling, and should have been a catalyst for bigger change than it ended up being, but it was a different era, and a lot of that, unfortunately, has kind of fallen by the wayside. So, yeah, I mean, I do agree with a lot of the sentiments you mentioned there, and again, I'm not as big a fan and hung up on the Hart family as a lot of people are. I know some people just absolutely live, and I was like Rick, you know, Gillespie, he, you know, he loved him some Bret Hart. Bret Hart, in ring, I've got no problem with him. He never totally blew me away in the ring. I mean, he had some great matches, sure, and that match with Stone Cold and Steve Austin was tremendous, but he just never motivated me to care about him. Just never did. He just, to me, was just bland. And, you know, if you like him, great. If you don't, well, you know, okay. All right, this is from Aaron, and Aaron says, "Member of the Empire for a while, just now enjoying your show." Well, thank you. "I like what you bring to the history aspect of things. I heard you bring up Rick Rude a couple times in your broadcast and was wondering a couple things for a while. First, I think the Meltzer book called Tributes, he cites that Rude's major part of his career and notoriety was in WWF. I just can't see this since I was thinking he was a top-tier heel in WCW. for Mainstay. He had several main events there and probably the second best faction next to the Horsemen of all times. Basically, seeing what's your opinion on his WWF versus WCW career, and if you think the Dangerous Alliance is perhaps the greatest stable of all time that wasn't the Horsemen. The Dangerous Alliance is one of the most underrated stables of all time. I mean, you know, it's one of those classic stables that doesn't get mentioned as often as some others do, because I think it occurred at a time where wrestling was very much on a low ebb. I mean, WCW was struggling to survive. But you had Polly Dangerously, Paul Heyman, who was the manager. He had Bobby Eaton, he had Arn Anderson, Larry Zbysko, and Rick Rude, and I think there were a few others who floated in and out of the Dangerous Alliance, but just a tremendous stable. But I have to agree that the peak of his career was in WWF. He was already having some injury problems by the time he got back to WCW, and his run there was on the verge of really taking off, but it just kind of faltered, and it never really played out as far as I think it should have because of injury. Sting did a dive on him out of a ring while they were wrestling in Japan, and it was a stupid thing to do. It wasn't your typical dive over the ropes. They were up on kind of this elevated platform where it stepped up like a foot or so. And the ring sat on that. So it was like a two-tiered sort of thing. You had the ring, and then you stepped down onto this elevated area, and then you stepped down again. So Sting shouldn't have been doing a dive. And, you know, I don't know if Sting caught any heat for this, but he should have, because it was a dumb idea. I mean, just watching it, you can see he shouldn't be doing it. But he dove over the ropes and hit Rude, and Rude took the bump back, and he hit his back on the elevation part and just destroyed his back. And that really ended his career. Now, he ended up, of course, doing the bodyguard role and stuff after that, and was supposedly training for a comeback when he died, but he was also supposed to get the NWA World title for Ric Flair when WCW pulled out of the NWA. They were in a big cluster over it. They were in a big had a big falling out with the National Wrestling Alliance over control of the world title. But Ric Flair was supposed to drop the belt to Rick Rude at Fall Brawl that year, and NWA didn't approve of that title change. They were wanting dates on the champion, and at that time WCW was not going to farm out their top talent to independent groups to defend this belt, which is what they wanted to happen. Dennis Corluzzo was president of the NWA at the time. And so the NWA world title ended up becoming just the quote world title, and then the international world title, and just become kind of a joke of a belt in one fell swoop. And so Rick Rude got, instead of winning the NWA world title, ends up getting the WCW international world title, or something stupid like that. So his time in that period, his post-WWF WCW career, was, I think, disappointing in the end. And he was certainly, wrestling was at a bigger stage when he was in WWF. I mean, he was the peak of the Hulkamania era. He had those very high-profile matches with Ultimate Warrior. Even though he was Intercontinental Champion and not World Champion, the Intercontinental Championship meant a whole hell of a lot more then than it does now. So it was just really apples and oranges comparing the two belts now. I mean, Intercontinental title back then was more on the level of like the SmackDown world title is now. It was really the second highest belt in the promotion, and had a lot of prestige to it. And so holding that belt was way more prestigious than holding the flipping WCW gold international world used to be NWA title that, you know, we can't call the NWA belt anymore, NWCW. Prior to his WWF run, of course, he was the American Heavyweight Champion, the world-class World Heavyweight Champion when that belt first when they first pulled out of the NWA out there in Texas. But that was on a much smaller level. World Class really was just starting their slide into hell at that point. So then he had a short run with the NWA World Tag Team titles with Manny Fernandez in Mid-Atlantic before he ended up going WWF. So really, I mean, I do think that the WWF run was the peak of Rick Rude's career. It is a shame that the Dangerous Alliance isn't more highly regarded and fondly remembered than it is, because it was really a mega top tier stable and should be looked back on more prominently than what it was. And Paulie Dangerously was, in my opinion, a great manager. Back then, he gets criticized a lot for being kind of a Jim Cornette clone, but I thought really Paulie Dangerously brought a nice spin to that whole thing as being this, you know, New York, whatever, that guy down south, sports agent or whatever. So, yeah, there were similarities. They were fast-talking, con men, non-athletes, who each carried a gimmick weapon to the ring. And so, yeah, I can see the criticism there. But Paulie Dangerously was just a fountain of charisma. And taking good workers who weren't particularly charismatic, like Arn Anderson and Larry Zbysko and Bobby Eaton, and putting them with him just made all the sense in the world. And those tag teams with Bobby Eaton and Arn Anderson was great. The Arn Anderson-Larry Zbysko tag team was great. Really, I think some of Larry Zbysko's best work post his Bruno Sammartino feud early in his career. All right, let's see. This is from Jimbo, and he says, Carl, what do you remember about the Starrcade dog collar match between Greg Valentine and Roddy Piper? Where did the build for this match take place, and were there any managers involved? Who went over? Was Piper's ear injury legit? Okay, that happened at Starrcade, 93, the first one. Big match, well remembered. It was a very heated match. The whole ear injury thing's kind of a cool story, because it goes to show one of the biggest problems I have with modern wrestling. It's that you don't trust the commentators anymore, because the commentators are made to look like fools and retards and not in the loop, have no clue what's going on. I don't believe nothing Mike Tenay tells me. I don't believe nothing Michael Cole tells me. Nothing Jerry Lawler tells me. I don't trust these people because they look stupid. They don't know what's going on, and they're scripted to look that way. Gordon Solie was a different matter. Gordon Solie was booked to, and not only him, but guys like Lance Russell and a lot of the territorial commentators, that was who they were. They sold the perspective the fan was supposed to have. Gordon Solie projected himself as this legitimate sports commentator, that he was just as trustworthy, just as skilled as a football commentator you'd listen to on the radio, just a sports journalist. And when you heard the guy, the way he presented himself and the way he was booked not to look stupid and the way he didn't look stupid, you believed him. You believed what he said. And of course, you know, he said that Valentine injured, you know, Piper's ear and everything, and it's been bought as legitimate ever since. And that's awesome. That's what made wrestling work. Nowadays, you think if for 1 minute Michael Cole or Mike Tenay told you that some dude's ear was permanently injured in a match, you think you would believe him for 1 second? Well, of course not. So that's, you know, it sold legitimacy. Piper had actually, the way I understand the story, had actually injured his ear years ago. And so it was one of those things that had kind of been talked about and whatever. And it looked shocking for him to bleed from his ear and stuff. Whereas most everybody, of course, bladed their forehead and stuff and got juice there. If you really didn't suspend disbelief, you would have to say, you know, people, generally speaking, in fights don't bleed from their forehead. It happens, yes, but usually not. Usually they bleed from around the eye or the nose or the mouth, but not generally right in the middle of their foreheads. And so that was, you know, a long time one of the critiques of the fake wrestling. You know, when you get to fights, you get a black eye and a busted lip, you don't bleed from the middle of your forehead. So Piper bleeding from an unusual location like his ear made it that much more real, especially since they were doing this dog chain gimmick. Now, Valentine was the United States champion at the time, although that belt wasn't on the line at Starrcade. It was a non-title match. And you say, well, why would you do that? Well, you know, you wouldn't do that today. But back then, it was done because it was presented as, well, the NWA is not going to sanction some brutal something like this with its title on the line. If you guys have this match, it's going to be unsanctioned. We're certainly, you know, it was viewed as taking away from the prestige of the title by having this wild, you know, out of control match to be, quote, sanctioned by the governing body. Something they would never think of nowadays, to even imply in the storyline. And so without that belt on the line, there was also no incentive for Greg Valentine to get himself disqualified, or, you know, took disqualifications out of it, because Piper was no longer trying to win the title. It was about hurting Valentine and getting revenge for jacking his ear up, which they were selling prior to the match. Not that it happened in the match, they were selling it prior to the match going in. And so they played on that, and that became the storyline. It's just great psychology. It's great storytelling, and it made the match all these years later memorable. Because people go, oh my God, you know, he made Roddy Piper deaf in one ear, and, you know, the belt wasn't even on the line because, you know, it was unsanctioned and all this stuff. And that's the little details they overlook nowadays that makes wrestling, quite frankly, not as entertaining as it once was, in my opinion. And another thing, again, like I said, you believe Gordon Solie when he said it. You believed how he sold it, and nowadays you wouldn't in a million years believe these goofballs that are announcing wrestling now, because there's no continuity to wrestling anymore. It's one of the things I really enjoyed about wrestling when I was a big fan of it back in the 80s. There was continuity to it. You knew I could turn on any promotion for the first time, and I knew some things up front. I knew that everybody there was fighting to be the top champion in that territory. And by winning that championship, they were in line for a shot at the world heavyweight champion, regardless of which world champion that was. So there was a overall theme. I didn't have to know about who's quitting or who's general manager or who's this bullshit and that and the other. I knew that when I turned on and there was a match in the ring, those two people were wrestling to try to either win a championship or improve their position to get to a championship. And depending on who won or lost and how they won or lost, depending on whether they developed a personal issue with the other person, that would spin off into a side program. So it made sense. And I knew the announcer, the commentator, the sportscaster was going to tell you what you needed to know. He was watching wrestling from your perspective. He was with the knowledge of what was happening in the ring, and he would relate this to you, and he told you what to think, and you would follow along. He was basically reading the story to you, and you were following along with it. It's not that way anymore. And, you know, you can't just... That's one of the things that nobody talks about. The reason that WWE, TNA, and all this other is the ratings tank are in the tank and they aren't improving is because it's inaccessible. You can't just walk in. I can't just walk in Monday night if I haven't watched wrestling in 10 years since WCW folded. I'm now decided I'm going to give, I'll give WWE a spin. I turn it on. I can't just jump in and understand what's going on. There's no continuity to it. There's There's all kinds of stuff going on that has the announcer isn't going to say, tell me that these two people here are having a match, and here's the history of that, and here's where they're going, which is what they would do in the past. It's all manner of just nonsense going on that you can't follow along, and it's never followed up on, and that's the point. They can sit there and they can say, you know, this is the program, it started like last week, and now we're here in the middle of it, and next week there may or may not be a follow-up to it. You know, who knows where it goes. It changes. It's just inaccessible. And I think that's one of the things that nobody talks about that they probably should, is that it's, wrestling is not new viewer friendly anymore like it used to be. Like I said, you know, back in 1987, I could turn on a brand new wrestling promotion I'd never seen before in my life. If I was traveling somewhere on vacation and I found myself, instead of in Birmingham, Alabama, I found myself in Dallas, Texas, I could turn on their local wrestling promotion and know all I needed to know before before the opening credits finally rolled. That these are people having matches for a desired goal to be the champion of their territory and ultimately the champion of the world. The announcer would tell me everything else I needed to know. Nowadays, that's not the case, because who cares? Who's even the champion? Hell if I even know. WWE has two world titles. Hell if I even know who's got them. I think Mark Henry's got one of them at the time I'm recording this. And, you know, who knows? And who cares? That's the thing. Who even cares? And these commentators ain't telling me nothing. I think Michael Cole is explaining to me why, you know, why Mark Henry's the world champion. How long has he had it? Where did he get it from? What's his motivation? Tell me something about these people. Nothing. No, they're selling goofiness and stupidity. And that's why, you know, and wrestling back in the classic era wasn't always great. There was a lot of stupid stuff going on there, too. But the announcers tried to sell it to you as best they could, even if it was a dumb idea. I mean, I remember Memphis all the time had some of the dumbest characters that would come along. But Lance Russell was a guy you could trust. I mean, Lance talked to you. Lance spoke just like he was you, just like he was watching it from the same perspective you were. And if it was dumb, he didn't just sit there and try to make you believe it. He would go, look, this is really an outlandish thing going on here. I don't know why he's dressed like that, but, you know, the guy is scary strong or scary fast or whatever, and sell you on what he could that made sense. And you know, it wasn't always a home run, but more often than not, it was. So, but anyway, that's that. So thanks a lot for listening. Again, we're running kind of a marathon thing this week, catching up on a lot of questions and stuff. I hope you're enjoying these shows. Again, follow me at Twitter as Dragon King Carl. Follow me on Facebook as Carl Stern. And do check out carlstern.com and pick up Stern Stick, which has hours and hours and hours and hours of audio, reading material, research material, all kinds of stuff on a flash drive. So do pick those up by way of PayPal. And again, go to carlstern.com and you can read all about it. Thanks a lot for listening.
Now, I can't help it that I'm custom made. I can't help it that I look good, smell good, woo, can dance all night long. I can't help it, but I'll tell you this.
And we're going to have Ginger the Real Animal Wrestling Bear right here on television in the next couple of weeks. So y'all be watching this Channel 24 for some of the greatest NWA wrestling.
Expiration of time match today. This one should be a good one. This is a mixed match with the grown men and the midgets.
6'9" tall. Kamala, 385 pounds.
My mama looked at me and she said, oh God, he looked like a saddlebag face. And she said, saddlebag face, I love you.
550 pounds of supple muscle.
We're going to take time out and get ready to get going with the Fabulous Ones coming up in just a moment. We'll be back with our first action right after we take time out for this.